you have game shows in Australia, Rosemary? Is that a thing?
Hey, I was a 5-time carryover champion on Wheel of Fortune.
What? Whoa. Rosemary, what was that?
I was a 5-time carryover champion on Wheel of Fortune. I don't know if they, is it the same in the US when you win an episode, you get to come back the next day?
Yes.
Yeah. So I did that 5 times. I was on six episodes.
How much money did you win?
It's not as rich as, I didn't win any cash. There's no cash in the Australian one. And it's not as rich as the US one. I think I won like 20, 30,000 worth of stuff. And yeah, it was pretty good as a uni student. I won a bed and like saucepans and a couple of lazy boy recliners, one that had massaging and a fridge. I won a houseboat cruise. I won, I don't know, an electric guitar. What else did I win? I won all sorts of stuff. So much.
Did this really happen, Rosemary?
This really happened when I was at uni.
Why we've not seen video of this? Why is this not on YouTube? I don't understand.
I have a VHF of it. I have been thinking that I should chase down the studio and see if I can get the recording. So I'm sure that they're archived, but I don't know how easy it is to get your hands on it.
Our producer needs this video badly. We have to get this back on the internet. Come on. Really? I didn't know that. It's not in your CV. Why wasn't that in your CV?
It used to be. It did literally used to be in my CV.
Wheel of Fortune couldn't have slipped in there somewhere?
It's probably not anymore, but for a very long time, it was on my CV in other. And it was one, it's a good way to see if people read your CV because there's no way you're reading that and not mentioning it at the interview. And two, when people did read it, then it's a really great icebreaker, you know, because it's just like, oh, okay, before we get started, we just have to chat about that. And then it's, you know, like it's a fun little thing to talk about. And then you're friends. And then the rest of the interview goes very nicely. Okay, that's like a hot pro tip for interviews is include something like that on there that will, you know, be a way to start the conversation and have everyone be relaxed before the interview.
Okay. I think Rosemary's been holding back. We've been bearing our soul every week, and Rosemary's keeping the Wheel of Fortune thing under wraps.
Well, now, I mean, the only thing I could put on my CV is that I used to live next to Rick James. I mean, what, you know, like...
Alan can put on that he's married to a real rocket scientist. That's a good one.
This is true. It's sort of guilt by association there. A startup called Radia, founded by MIT-trained rocket scientist Mark Lundstrom, is developing the world's largest cargo plane called the Windrunner. Now, you're asking yourself, why is it called the Windrunner and it's an airplane? Because it's meant to transport wind turbine blades, of course. And Rosemary pointed this article out to me a couple of days ago with a whole bunch of calculations about the megawatts per mile traveled or something of the sort. So I thought, okay, we need to talk about this and get it out, all out. We get out of our systems about this airplane. Now, let me give you the promo on this. If this thing works, it would enable the installation of onshore wind turbines pretty easily by just sticking them in the back of this airplane and flying them to the site. Because the way this airplane is designed, it could conceivably take blades as long as, I think, 120 meters long.
But how long a runway does it need to take off and land? Is there a suitable runway in proximity to every onshore wind farm that wants 120 meter long blades?
Well, based on the shape of that airplane, it would be about a mile long runway, which is pretty easy to do. There's thousands of them in the United States, maybe tens of thousands of them in the United States.
Next question, do people want such large rotors on onshore wind turbines? I mean, offshore, you put a rotor on a tower that is barely taller than the, you know, the blade, so that you just make sure that it's never going to hit the water, and, you know, add a tiny bit of a safety factor in case there's a huge storm that's, you know, unpredicted. But onshore, you need to get up away from wind shear. You can't, you know, you because yeah, so wind shear is the effect that slows down the wind close to the ground. So there's a big difference between wind speed at the ground and the wind speed 100 meters up and, you know, 150 meters up. So you can't have such a big wind gradient that you've got your blades really close to the ground on an onshore wind turbine. So got a 120 meter long blade, I'm going to say you're going to want a 150 meter tall tower. Is that we're just, I don't understand why the aeroplane is the first part, is the first part of this puzzle. If we're going to move to that, wouldn't the push come from people who are like, okay, we've got this gigantic onshore wind turbine. If only we had a way to install it more places than where we can currently get it to. And then, you know, Windrunner's like, ah, solution. Here it is, but I haven't seen anybody requesting really large onshore wind turbines that can't be transported.
So my answer to that is that they've already raised $100 million and they're valued at $1 billion. So I don't have to answer that question. Just follow the money. I think what's happening is they realize that building a blade factory is really expensive and you can fly blades into places. And building a runway that's a mile long is not particularly hard to do. And subsequently, I do think there's applications for package delivery or like an Amazon service. Remember, Amazon tried to start, or it has started its own airline, essentially, or freight service. So they fly their own airplanes or they rent airplanes to fly around to carry cargo. When Amazon thinks about the next stage of that, they're going to need bigger airplanes. That's just what's going to happen. And this would feed that market also. So I think there's sort of two parts to it. You can question the efficiency of it and all that stuff. I totally fine. But somebody thinks it's worth $100 million. Well, they're valued at $1 billion. So somebody thinks it's worth $1 billion today. So there must be some rationale behind it.
Okay, but let's just be real here. There are a very large number of highly valued companies, especially startups, and especially there's a lot of clean techs that have no prospect of ever making any money, that have, you know, like just because they've got a high valuation doesn't, I think that's a crazy way to think of it. Oh, because people have invested money in it, then it must be worth that much money. I mean,
if the world was all right, Microsoft wouldn't exist, right? That if it came down to whether it was useful or not, there'd be a lot of products that didn't exist. But it depends on where the money is. And if they can provide transport in an efficient way, and they may want to develop their own wind farms, probably where they're going, then maybe they want to have their own airplane to go do this thing. And the upper end of the cargo lifting world in the airplane market is being destroyed one airplane at a time at the moment. So there's not a lot of really big airplanes to go do this job. And if you need them, it usually runs, the last numbers I heard to get a flight of the Russian airplane that does a lot of this is about $1 million a flight. That's pretty good money if you can get it.
Yeah, and how often is that being done? Almost never. I mean, I'll read out what I sent you when I questioned about whether this was sensible, because I'm doing a video on shipping at the moment, so I've been comparing different modes of transport. I'll read out a quote from my upcoming video. To transport 1 ton of goods 1 kilometer in a cargo ship takes about 1.7 to 4 megajoules of energy. Rail's a bit higher, around 2.4 to 5. Road is 7 to 18. So, you know, there's the range. Low end for cargo ship, 1.7. High end for road is 18. And then for air travel, it's 200 to 350 megajoules per ton kilometer. It's, you know, like it's 100 times more energy. Fuel is a significant cost. It's just, I mean, you can make it a little bit more efficient, but you're never going to bring that to the point where you would choose air over any other method of transport if you had any kind of a say in it. And I don't see the pull for it. It's not like people are crying out to install these gigantic wind turbines and there's no other way but to transport it by aeroplane, you know. And even if it turns out that we do end up wanting to install gigantic offshore-sized wind turbines onshore, there are other solutions as well that we've covered on this channel. I mean, there's split blades, there's thermoplastic blades will be coming in the future. You'll weld them together on site. There's towers that you can print in situ, or, you know, other ways of building towers on site instead of transporting the sections, the tower sections in a, you know, a one whole cross section at a time. I just think this is a classic case of a solution looking for a problem. And it sounds cool, which is a really great way to get millions of dollars of investment. And I think that's going to be the end of it. I mean, for sure, they might pivot into transporting packages or something where there's a bit more of a margin that people really care about the extra speed. That's something that they're willing to pay more for. But, you know, wind turbines are planned, wind farms are planned years in advance. And I know from working in the logistics that the cheapest mode of transport is a really important part of the planning of the whole project from the start. And they do transport blades by aeroplane every now and then, once in a blue moon. Obviously not as large as what this aeroplane can do, but, it has been done before. And it's, you know, it's either because someone massively stuffed up and, you know, there's something, the whole project is ground to a halt because of some transport issue, or it's a gimmick to be like, hey, look at this cool thing we did.
There is no gimmicks in aerospace. Because it costs too much money.
Yeah, no gimmicks in aerospace. I mean, aren't there like 100 startups in in personal air taxis that are maybe crying out as being the exact definition of a gimmick? I mean, come on.
They're not gimmicks. So they either succeed or they fail horribly. There really is no middle ground. I mean, it has destroyed the careers of many a person that have gotten into aerospace. And Phil's been in aerospace. He's seen it too. There's been a lot of airplane designs that were great on paper and had some reasonable amount of funding that never got to the end. In today's world, to build that airplane, billion, maybe a little more, maybe two, to get that airplane built because of just the factories and the people and stuff.
Yeah, let's be clear, they haven't built one.
It's definitely a design. They haven't built the first airplane yet. But it wouldn't take them all that much time to at least get a prototype up in the air, I don't think. It's really getting it sort of, as Phil has pointed out to me numerous times before we started this conversation, the FAA is going to have a lot to say about it. And that's probably where the slowdown will occur.
Well, yeah. I mean, the FAA is one thing. Let's talk, in addition to what Rosemary just mentioned in terms of energy efficiency per ton kilometer or per ton mile, there's also cost per ton mile or cost per ton kilometer, which is the metric that they use in the logistics world to figure out how, you know, you move things in a cost-efficient manner. We looked at similar technology to this about 13 years ago with a dirigible, actually two different dirigible companies that wanted to do heavy lift cargo for on-site transportation and installation of blades or towers, or in some cases, the whole turbine, where you just literally pick the whole turbine and that's fully assembled in a factory-controlled environment reasonably controlled environment. And then, you just install the whole turbine like you would in offshore, for instance. The problem is not only does the cost per ton mile not trade at all. Like, again, it's if you're talking about the order of magnitude difference between like truck and rail versus air in energy that Rosemary just mentioned, it's about the same factor in terms of cost per ton mile between truck and rail and, you know, air transport, including either sky crane by conventional helicopter or, air freight for cargo. So the reality of this is it's never gonna, the industry is so locked into low cost solutions that they're absolutely never gonna adopt something this expensive. The other problem is also getting the FAA permits to be able to do, you know, like, if you're going to, I mean, what's the point of doing this if you can ship, you know, hundreds of blades on a rail car, and then offload them onto trucks, and then do your last mile, quote unquote, last mile transportation through trucks. Why, other than speed, what are you really getting out of transporting, you know, a handful, like maybe up to three blades at a time for one turbine? You're going to have to make like 70 trips to fully outfit your wind farm with, you know, parts delivered by an airplane. So it just, I don't like, this is one of those, like, it might be technologically feasible, but it's not commercially viable. And it just doesn't seem to trade for me.
Maybe the answer is in the question. Founded by MIT-trained rocket scientists, what if this has something to do with moving rocket parts around? Starship.
Which, again, makes a lot more sense than wind turbine blades. Yeah.
Remember, they moved the space shuttle on top of the 747, which was crazy to see, by the way, but that happened. So are we talking about rocket parts?
No, if it's one-offs, it makes a lot more sense than where you've got to set up, you know, like you've got a wind farm, you transport many of the same thing and you do the same installation over and over again over a period of months or years if it's a big one. I just can't wrap my head around this ever being a better solution than, you know, the kinds of things that Phil mentioned a minute ago. But if it's one-off, really expensive things that are, you know, fragile and it's not worth setting in place all the other things that you have to worry about, then yeah, sure. If it's transporting things to a remote launch site, could make more sense. And also, who calls himself rocket scientist? That's what I want to know.
I'm a rocket scientist. Thank you very much.
I'm a rocket scientist too. I did a course, and I did a year of aerospace engineering. I did the course on jet propulsion, and I remember thinking as I passed that exam, hey, I'm officially a rocket scientist now.
There's only one person in this group that actually is a rocket scientist, and that's my wife, because she did launch rockets into space, and she is a Princeton trained rocket engineer.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah, so there is a rocket scientist. So I'll throw one more thing at you, because I think this is another place to go. I mean, Airbus has built special airplanes to haul airplane parts around, and so has Boeing. Both of them have designed special airplanes to haul airplane parts around, fuselage sections, wings, the whole bit, right? So this would just fill that market. I do think we're missing the point here that FedEx exists for a reason, because people want things quickly. And if you go down to Memphis at nighttime and watch all the airplanes coming in and out of Memphis, there's a lot of cargo that's moved that you wouldn't otherwise pay for.
Yeah, it's for that time when you spent 6 years planning a giant wind farm, and then you realize at the last second, oh no, we forgot to order blades. We better overnight them. That's the problem that this airplane is solving, which does not exist. And I think that you've really hit the nail on the head where you have mentioned, you know, this is someone coming from an aero background, taking like the kind of thing that's done in the aero industry and thinking that it's going to apply to wind turbines. Strike tape is literally the only one that I know about. And I don't know how much you had to change things, but these really expensive solutions that you come up with for aerospace, you know, and I saw it all the time in de-icing, you know, the kind of solution that you can have in aerospace, it can be so much more expensive. It can involve so much more, you know, like human intervention as well, you know, wind turbine stuff. It's cheap, and it's things that you can roll out, and they're durable, and they just last without anybody, you know, poking around and maintaining all the time. So to me, this is just another, like, a really expensive and well-funded example of someone making the same mistake that, you know, just because they perceive that the wind industry has a similar problem to what has already been solved in aero, that, you know, the aero solution is going to apply. They just, it never works, with the single exception of strike tape.
The final reason why I don't think this is going to work for wind turbine component transportation, at least unless it's an extreme one-off situation, is we forget the insurance industry. They have to sign off on whatever the mode of transportation is. And at the end of the day, this is not something that they're going to get on board with very quickly and easily. This is a monumentally expensive way. There's huge risk. You've got things that are normally transported by truck and rail now being flown overhead, you know, over population centers and things like that. The insurance industry and the FAA are going to have a field day with this. And it's, not, I guess, maybe pun intended, but it's never going to get off the ground.
If the folks at Radia are looking for a lightning engineer to help them with the design, call WeatherGuard. We'll help you.
Hey, Uptime listeners. We know how difficult it is to keep track of the wind industry. That's why we read PES Wind Magazine. PES Wind doesn't summarize the news. It digs into the tough issues, and PES Wind is written by the experts, so you can get the in-depth info you need. Check out the wind industry's leading trade publication, PES Wind, at peswind.com.
So I actually brought the PES Wind magazine with me today because I have forgotten it the last couple of weeks. So if you haven't gotten your latest edition of PES Wind, it's out and you can get it at peswind.com. And there, this one is, this episode of the magazine, this edition of the magazine has a lot of great articles in it. And the one I saw that I want to talk about is the CLS Wind and their lifting platform to a simple wind turbine. So they kind of have, if you think about the way you build a tower, you have this really big crane and it lifts this tower section up, you stack it, you bolt it on, you go to the next one. So it takes a lot of big cranes to get this job done. What they've done instead is made like a cog train. Rosemary, do you know what that is? Like, have you ever been to up a steep mountain in Switzerland and you take one of those trains and it has a cog on it?
Yeah, a rack.
It's similar to that on the backside of a wind turbine. Pikes Peak has a similar train. Phil, you've been on one of these things. So it's like a geared system with the platform that raises the next section of the wind turbine up, and then you just slide it over and drop it on, bolt it on, keep going. So it makes like a built-in elevator with the turbine. Now, we've seen a lot of ideas about how to install turbines faster, right? That seems to be a big pain point with cranes, because cranes, you got to call the cranes, got to be there, it's expensive. This system and others like it are really trying to revolutionize the way we build wind turbines. And what I'm guessing is the backing behind it to do this. Is there an industry drive or to do something like this, which is unique and probably will save a bunch of money, versus just the rapid need to get turbines deployed? Is there a disconnect there? And that, should we be looking at something more like a CLS wind system, which is more integral with the turbine and makes it cheaper to install? Do the OEMs just not care? Like, once it goes out the door, they'll figure it out.
I mean, for offshore, I actually think this makes some sense, this or something kind of akin to this type of a solution. It's not the first time it's been proposed. And Valmont actually is probably the company that investigated this very early. They had patents dating back to like 2001 or two, I want to say, on kind of a lifting platform where you could kind of, build the turbine sequentially. There's also companies out there like Nabra Wind is also, trying to do towers, and they've, done some demos in Spain and in Africa, and they licensed the technology to China. Conceptually, I like the idea of, again, whether it's a slip form tower or, what CLS Wind is doing, conceptually, I like it. The challenge is kind of twofold. One, I think it makes a much more sense for bigger, either onshore turbines or definitely for offshore. If you're talking about like an 18 to 20, or, the Chinese are now trying to design, 25 to 30 megawatt offshore wind turbines, I think you probably need a solution like this to be able to install it, because you were never going to have a boom crane big enough to be able to do, a turbine that's got like a, 280 meter hub height, because it's got a, 400 meter rotor kind of, on a 30 megawatt wind turbine. So you're necessarily going to have a solution like this if you want to go really big offshore. We'll never have vessels that are going to be capable of doing the installation or the maintenance on components. So I think this is a good idea, kind of conceptually. Aside from some of the commercial challenges, the biggest thing is also, whether or not this thing is actually built to withstand, because these, Alan, you were talking about like these systems in Switzerland or whatever. you know, they get serviced very frequently. This thing, I don't know if it's now an extra thing that you've got to service and maintain as part of the turbine to be able to do your component swap outs. You know, it does add some cost and complexity, but it does also facilitate you going to, you know, potentially a large onshore or definitely a huge offshore turbine.
Let me ask Rosemary this, because the wind catcher system, right, which is sort of that wall of wind turbines, does that approach to building something that massive require something like the CLS wind system in order to build it efficiently, that you need to sort of hoist it up in place with a little more technology than just bringing a big crane out?
Yeah, no, they've got their own assembly and maintenance infrastructure kind of incorporated into the wind catching design. So it's like as lifts that run up the, there's that big grid structure with the little rotors in it, and there's all these, you know, verticals along. So on the verticals, they have these lifts, and they can slot blades in and out and other big components in and out that way, because, yeah, they're imagining, you know, obviously if you go from, I can't remember the exact number, but if you go from, you know, one rotor to 49 different rotors, if it's a 7x7 grid, then you're probably going to need to do maintenance more often, right? So they're imagining that you're going to have to be able to get those components in and out. So they've integrated the installation and maintenance as part of it. And also for seeing, you know, like many others, that installation is one of the things that's getting, you know, the challenge of installation is getting harder faster than the size of the turbines grow. You know, a little bit bigger turbine is starting to make a lot bigger headache for installation. So most of the people that are coming up with innovative turbine solutions for offshore especially really have installation and maintenance are some of the core reasons why they see that things need to go a different direction than just making things really huge. That, and I mean, there's a few other things as well, but those are amongst the most important. So, yeah, I think it is time to stop just thinking about doing things the way that they have been done and just go bigger, 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 because some things are starting to get really ridiculous, like the cranes. And I mean, in Australia, even for onshore wind turbines in Australia, if you've got a blade defect problem on a wind farm that was commissioned a while ago, and so, you know, all your installation stuff is gone, you know, that crane is gone and it's installing another wind farm, it's not so easy to get your hands on one in Australia, even for the onshore turbines. So, you know, it might be a solution that you create because people that are installing really big wind turbines, that, you know, they have a need for it. They just simply can't install it without that. But I do see that it will filter downwards as well into the kind of existing technology. They also have a bit of a problem. You know, it's not something that is make or break for the existing wind farms, but it is certainly, you know, on the blade defect problems that I work on, a lot of the times it's dragging out what, you know, might have been a couple of month campaign might turn into closer to a year, because you've got to worry about getting the crane on site and that sort of thing.
Wow. So maybe the CLS wind type system would make sense then, like to be able to just basically bolt something on and then elevate it down on a platform. That'd be cool.
Is it something that does it need to be there from the start? Is it, you know, is it, does design change to the turbine, or is it something you can just come back to an existing turbine and, you know, install a few components and then away you go?
Well, if it's not designed to do that, they should design it to do that, because I think that's a good idea.
It is. Like you said, Australia is probably the marketplace for this because of the access to cranes, right? You design the towers to handle this system, and then when you need to do a major, an MCE, you just do it. You don't have to wait for a crane to come out. It makes infinite sense. That's going to do it for this week's Uptime Wind Energy podcast. Thanks for listening. Please give us a 5-star rating on your podcast platform and subscribe in the show notes below to Uptime Tech News, our weekly newsletter. And check out Rosemary's YouTube channel, Engineering with Rosie. And we'll see you here next week on the Uptime Wind Energy podcast.